Bryant. I'm the attorney representing the appellant, Karen Bryant. For the record, I did not represent her at trial or during the petition. I did submit her brief.
In that regard, can you tell me why your assignment of error number two does not appear to be included in the petition?
Yes, sir. I understand that there's probably not a rule to provide for changing the assignments of error.
The rule is just to the contrary.
The rule is the opposite.
Yeah, there's not probably. Definitely is.
There's definitely. The issue was preserved at trial, and I understand if you can't consider it. I apologize for any confusion on that matter. I'd like to begin with the Rule 2404B character analysis. At trial, as reflected in the appendix, an objection was raised by defense counsel at trial, objecting to relevance as to evidence pertaining to previous allegations that Ms. Bryant had brought. The judge, the Commonwealth responded that it was relevant because it pertained to her veracity. The judge overruled the objection as part of his investigation.
One of the elements of this offense is an intent to mislead.
Yes, sir.
And she was asked directly whether she had filed any other sexual assault complaints, and she was not truthful in her answer. Why isn't that relevant as to whether or not she had the intent to mislead the officer as to this particular allegation?
Well, I think that if we are to allow some leeway to the appellant at the time, she at that time didn't understand that she was actually under investigation, which I believe she was, because I believe the police officer obviously knew at that point that there was some question over some allegations she had made in the past. If Miss Bryant is, she's not a sophisticated woman. She's probably well below average intelligence, not educated. At the time that she responded to the officer, I don't know that she remembered those allegations because they were from a period of years earlier.
But from a legal standpoint, why isn't that relevant? If you provide false information in response to a direct question by an officer, why doesn't that tend to prove that your intent in the entire statement was to mislead the officer?
Well, I believe that at the time that she answered him, she may not have remembered, and then it was presumed that she was lying, and it moved on. There could have been other reasons.
Well, do you have any case law that we could point to? I mean, if I had to write the opinion, what case law would I cite to support the idea that these weren't in any way relevant?
To the extent that it could have been relevant, I think that next we would have to go to the balancing test, and the court never got to the balancing test. The court summarily determined that it was relevant. As it moved on, and the Commonwealth attempted to introduce additional evidence, defense attorney again raised the objection. At that point, this would be on page 24, 25 of the appendix, the prosecutor at that point was the one who invoked Rule 2404B, indicating that from the Commonwealth's perspective that these prior allegations were in fact bad acts, and that they were at that point, just because something may be relevant doesn't mean that it comes in. And the legislature has laid out a groundwork in the rule itself for certain issues to which prior bad acts can be.
The allegations themselves aren't bad acts, are they? It's only bad acts if you're demonstrated to have been lying about them, and there was no proof adduced to try to show that she was lying about previous allegations, were there?
Well, I think that proof is circumstantial. The no true bill from the grand jury that was admitted, the having multiple witnesses come in and testify that she had brought forth reports, and then there was no evidence to show that any of these reports ever materialized anything, there's an inference that they were in fact bad acts, and I think that the Commonwealth admits that by referring to Rule 2404B, because if they didn't think that they were bad acts, then they never would have invoked Rule 2404B. and the matter probably would have begun and ended with, hey, she was not completely truthful with the investigator at the time. There's a limited scope of relevance there. The trial court could have taken it for what it's worth and moved on to other aspects of the trial.
But this was a, even if we assume that they were not admissible, or that I should say not admissible, but they were overly prejudicial. This is a bench trial, and we presume that our trial judges are able to separate out the purpose for which something is being admitted and not consider it for other purposes. Why would we presume that this trial court would consider this for anything other than proof of the element of the offense?
Well, sir, I think that comes to play in two aspects of the trial. First of all, the trial court, I believe, could have and should have, taking the evidence, noting the objection, taking the evidence under advisement, until the trial court didn't know what the evidence was going to be at that point. After the trial court had heard both the government and defense counsel on all the evidence, could then, in fact, conduct the balancing test that's provided for in the rule to determine whether or not the prejudicial effect outweighed the probative value. And then, in fact, at the end of the trial, the trial court declared that this is just incredible. Incredible. It said it twice. Which that tends to show that there was a level of prejudice, because I don't believe that there was anything in the record other than the mountain of evidence pertaining to previous allegations that was incredible.
That guess it kind of leads me into the other question I had about that. Even if we agree with you on your argument, the evidence in this case seems to be overwhelming.
Yes,
that
sir.
This was a false report, particularly. I mean, you look at all of everything she did, her subsequent contacts with the person she claimed had assaulted her. You read the text messages. I mean, it doesn't take an awful lot to figure out what was going on.
Yes,
here.
Sir. I have a couple of different points I'd like to raise with regard to that.
So I guess my question is, isn't this harmless, even if it is erroneous?
Absolutely not, sir. She was maxed out on confinement. She was given 12 months in confinement, and that confinement is a reflection of the evidence that was presented at trial. And if the evidence at trial is contrary to the rules of evidence, which are there to ensure that she receives a fair trial, if the rules are disregarded and she doesn't receive a fair trial, and then she gets maxed out during the sentencing portion with regard to confinement, then that, on its face, tends to show that it was prejudicial and that she didn't get a fair trial and that the case should be overturned.
Couldn't the 12 months also be reflective of somebody falsely accusing someone of a sexual offense?
Well, sir, I believe that the sentence, the court needs to consider the full realm of punishments available under the statute. That includes the maximum and also includes the minimum. We can't presume that anybody convicted of the offense is automatically going to receive the maximum. And if somebody does,
wouldn't these be admissible for purposes of sentencing in any event?
I think that I don't believe so. I don't believe
if the Commonwealth were able to establish that these were false, these were prior false reports, couldn't the Commonwealth introduce that for purposes of punishment?
Sir, they didn't establish that. They argued it, but they didn't establish. They argued it through the mechanism.
You just told me a moment ago that they were false reports because of the introduction of the No True Bill indictment.
I do believe that they argued it, but I don't believe that they established
it. You just argued that there was evidence that these reports were false. These prior reports were false because of the No True Bill indictment.
Yes, sir. I think that was the direction that they were taking the argument. I don't think that they established facts sufficient to prove, but I do believe that they established facts sufficient or evidence sufficient to taint the proceedings.
Well, the judge in his ruling did not allude to the other acts which were the contested evidence, did he? He alluded to the text and the evidence
is
presented with regard to that particular
thing. Yes, ma'am. He said, I mean, it seems to me the language he used, that this is just incredible, that encompassed the trial as a whole. And another point that I would like to make along these lines is, you know, in the appellee's brief, they invoked a case, Lafon versus the Commonwealth. I believe that they did so incorrectly. They indicated that the that under Rule 2404B, even if it doesn't fit under the premises that are laid out in the actual rule, if it is relevant to any element in the case, that it automatically should be admissible. But the element that, they use to prove that is veracity, and that's or the grounds for that, and that's not an element of the offense. Veracity is a character trait which may be relevant, but the actual case law says a material element. And I would point out to the court that there's a difference between a material element and a character trait. And in fact, Rule 2404A1 specifically says that character traits can be raised by the defense and the prosecution in rebuttal. And the character trait of veracity was never raised by defense at trial. It was raised by the prosecution, and that's improper under Rule 2404A1. It doesn't come in under 2404B because they are never able to link it to a material. There's no material fact at issue. And in the case law that they cited, LaFawn versus the Commonwealth, specifically addresses that a balancing test must again happen. And there was no balancing test that was ever conducted at trial. A balancing test is a legal mechanism. It's not an issue for the jury. So it's, I believe, irrelevant that it was a bench trial, because the legal analysis would have had to been done by the judge, whether it was a bench trial or a jury trial.
Mr. Wynn, you're well into your rebuttal. You can continue if you wish. You may reserve the remainder.
There's one final point that I want to raise, and that's with regard to the motion to strike when evidence insufficient. They didn't put on any evidence to prove intent to deceive. And the Commonwealth responded, well, we don't know what's in her head, but we know that she reported it for the purpose of having him arrested. She never requested to have him arrested. And in fact, she never reported it to the police. She went to the hospital for medical treatment. The hospital contacted the police. Law enforcement then contacted her. She was not a zealous.
But she maintained her story to law enforcement.
When they came to her, they requested information. They requested a cell phone, a written statement. She never provided those. And then at some point, she withdrew. She did repeat her account of affairs.
When an individual goes to the hospital and reports being raped, isn't the logical result of that the police are notified and will investigate?
There's no evidence that she requested that this be reported to the police. And the only, I believe that we're limited to the evidence that was presented at trial. That was never, those were facts that were not brought out at trial, that were argued by the counsel for the government, both at trial and in their brief.
But how do you credibly say that she didn't report it to police when police respond to her performing an investigation as to whether or not a rape occurred, and she maintains the story that she was raped? She certainly knows the logical consequences of maintaining that story rather than saying that, no, nothing happened to me at that point.
Well, sir,
so how is that not a report to law enforcement?
I'm not saying she didn't report to law enforcement. I'm saying that she didn't do it with the intent to deceive. That's the element they have to prove. And when asked how they prove that, they said, well, we can imply it because she did this to get him arrested. But there's no evidence. Her initial report.
Also, go back to Judge Petty's point of when she's asked directly by the investigator whether or not she's ever made complaints in the past, she's not honest with the investigator.
Well,
doesn't the totality of circumstances lead to the logical inference that she did it with the intent to mislead?
I don't believe so. I believe their establishment of her dishonesty to law enforcement for things that happened as long as 15 years or almost 15 years earlier could be attributed to a number of things. She could be concerned that, hey, if I had reported other instances in the past and they weren't prosecuted, and then this may influence this particular detective not to prosecute this case. So there's room for other conclusions than she was lying to them because she was trying to hide some kind of pattern. And they never did any kind of...
The explanation you just showed is an attempt to hide it because you're afraid of how that might influence the investigator in this particular circumstance.
If she believed that she wouldn't be taken seriously, but that doesn't mean that she's intending to deceive law enforcement with regard to this particular offense. Not, the element isn't, does she intending to deceive law enforcement on something that happened a long time ago. It's, is she intending to deceive law enforcement about this particular offense? And their response was that the evidence was that she was trying to get this individual arrested. And I would submit to the court that if that was her case, she wouldn't have gone to the hospital. She would have marched down to the police station and filed the report.
Mr. Wendy, your allotted time for argument has expired. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Ms. Johnson?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Victoria Johnson. I represent the Commonwealth. I apologize. I wasn't in the courtroom when my case was called.
We were running a little early.
I was out in the hall. Apologize. Just real briefly on the sufficiency of the evidence issue. As the court noted a moment ago, the totality of the circumstances in this case militate towards the conclusion that the defendant acted with the intent to mislead law enforcement when she made this false report.
Beth, let me ask you a question about that. Isn't the intent to mislead really established by the evidence that the Commonwealth put on that the crime never happened, that the rape never happened? Isn't that really what the court relied on, and doesn't that establish the intent to mislead?
I think it does go to that, Your Honor. I think that also goes to the false report, though.
Okay. So how does the admission of the other reports that she made in the past, isn't that really to show that she's the type of person that makes reports of rapes that never occur?
No, Your Honor. That it also goes towards the intent to mislead, because the defendant knew full well what the result would be of making a rape claim. Regardless of whether the former reports were false or not, she knew what would happen when she reported a sexual assault. In other words, the prior reports went towards showing that she knew what the consequences of her actions would be.
But what if these reports were true? What if these prior reports were true?
I don't believe that the falsity of the reports is exactly the turning point here. I think that even if they were true, and we did have testimony in the record that indicated that, you know, possibly they weren't. We had an investigating officer come and testify, and then there was the no true bill that was put into evidence. But even if they were true, for the purposes of proving up this case, it goes to the intent to mislead, because the defendant knew what would happen when she made a rape allegation or
if
a sexual assault allegation.
If the officer had not asked about these prior complaints, would the Commonwealth have been able to introduce them in evidence at trial?
Possibly.
That's your theory, isn't it? That they were admissible.
I think that they're admissible in and of themselves. Yes, Your Honor, because for the reason I just articulated, I think that if the officer hadn't specifically asked about them, I don't know that the Commonwealth would have ever gone down that road. I think that's what made the officer suspicious and made the officer start to investigate that. I also note that these reports, I believe, were in a couple of different jurisdictions. I think that there might have finally been some communication where folks realized that there was, you know, reports going across a couple different counties there. And these are a lot of reports. I mean, it's seven sexual assault allegations over a 9-year period of time.
So how does the prejudicial effect of that, how is that outweighed by probative value when you have direct evidence from the texts and from the witness who said the rape never occurred? And then you've got this other evidence out here that she had made some complaints in the past.
Well, as the court noted before, this is a bench trial. Mm-hmm. And that balancing test was done by the judge. We don't have the judge saying on the record, I hereby balance this. But we are dealing with a trial judge, and we presume that our trial judges know the law and follow it and can separate the wheat from the chaff, in the words of the older cases. And this judge was able to look at this evidence and give it the weight to which it was entitled.
Well, what about the Mr. Wendt's argument that because the maximum sentence was imposed, the judge may have considered those for more than just proof of an element of the offense.
That's purely speculative, Your Honor. In this case, we have the defendant taking the stand herself and telling a story. The judge reacted to the defendant's demeanor and character on the stand. The judge was also reacting to quite a serious crime, making a false allegation of a felony and two sexual assaults against someone with really no basis. It is a pretty shocking crime. I think it shocked the conscience of the court. The court said that it was incredible to him. The court relied on the text messages and the defendant's own demeanor and own statements on the stand that day. The court did not, as this court noted a moment ago, did not allude to the prior acts in making its determination, in making its finding of guilt and pronouncing sentence. So I submit that Mr. Wendt's argument that the court was highly prejudiced by these other reports is not supported by the record. We have here a defendant who gave three versions of a story accusing this man of sexually assaulting her twice. The stories were inherently incredible. The details did not make sense. The fact finder could have easily concluded that this was all made up. We also have the text messages here, and the text messages are pretty obvious. You know, you can see their relationship kind of spiral down over a few days, especially on February 16th and 17th, and then on the 18th she went and reported to the hospital that she had been raped 9 days prior. This case is quite unfortunate, and it's the facts are very sad. But I submit here that there was no error, and even if there were error, it's harmless on this record because of the overwhelming evidence of guilt. If the court has other questions, I'm happy to answer.
You know, back on that harmless argument,
yes,
again, this was a misdemeanor bench trial. There was no evidence presented regarding sentencing. It was not a separate sentencing hearing.
Correct.
The judge immediately pronounced guilt and then gave her the maximum sentence. So how do we conclude that it was harmless? How do we satisfy ourselves that it could not have affected that sentence?
Excuse me, Your Honor. I submit that the court makes the same analysis that it would make in any case. The court is not looking at the sentencing evidence when it makes a harmless error determination in any sufficiency of the evidence case or any other case. Instead, the court looks at the evidence of guilt. Here, the evidence of guilt was overwhelming. The defendant took the stand herself. The court obviously disbelieved her. The court said twice, "This is incredible. This is the most overwhelming, beyond a reasonable doubt." Or, I'm sorry, I misquoted a little bit there. Let me get it exactly right because I noted it. "This is incredible to me, just absolutely incredible. I've never seen a more overwhelming, beyond a reasonable doubt case." That is a judge that is relying on evidence of guilt. That is not a judge that is relying on prejudicial statements or who is relying on anything else but this defendant who just got up on the stand and lied. And I submit that the fact finder could have easily come to that conclusion.
I'm not sure that if it was erroneously admitted that I can, quote, say with confidence that it did not affect that sentence. So that's what we have to conclude in order to apply harm. This is a non-constitutional harmless error.
It's non-constitutional.
But we still have to have to be able to say with confidence that it did not affect that sentence. And I'm not sure that it meets that standard.
Your Honor, I submit that given the seriousness of the charge and the other evidence of guilt, that there is just nothing else in the record indicating that the court would have given any other sentence. This is a false allegation of two felony charges, two serious felony charges, two sexual assaults. Not only would the man who the defendant falsely accused in this case face criminal charges, a criminal trial, and, you know, the ruinous expenses and the life, the devastating consequences to his life, he would also, even if these charges had been brought, his reputation would have been ruined. So I don't think it's at all untoward for the court to give her the maximum sentence on the misdemeanor. This is a very serious case. And to say that the prior charge evidence was overly prejudicial or was wrongly admitted and affected the sentence is purely speculative on this record. I think that the Commonwealth is perhaps being asked to prove a negative when the burden is actually on the appellant to prove the error here. And
I think if
oh if well it is harmless,
harmless
error you're right
you,
it is on me
on you.
It is on me, you're right. But Your Honor, there's just nothing there to indicate that she would have gotten any other kind of sentence. And furthermore, Your Honor, I don't think that you need to reach the issue because this evidence was properly admitted. It goes to prove an element of the offense. If the court has other questions, I'm happy to give it another shot. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
We will greet counsel. Our next case on the